Hi, everybody. My name's Dan Penner. I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
I'm grateful to be here sober tonight. Is it just a year? It seems like longer. It's a pleasure to be back at the Glass House and see some friendly faces and a lot of faces that I don't recognize but we're the same folks. I remember when I went to my very first meeting and I looked around and there were people with bright eyes and they weren't drinking, they said, and I wasn't sure I believed that, but what I found was that we were all alike in that we all had a problem with booze. And you guys had a solution. You were willing to share it with me for fun and for free, and I'm really grateful for that. I didn't set out to be an alcoholic. I thought I was too young and too cute to be an alcoholic. And I'd watched my mom die of this disease in 1975. And God, I didn't want to be like that. But there I was getting up every morning saying I'm not going to drink today, and by 5 o'clock I'd be drinking. It was awful. So I came to you guys and the miracles started happening. Eve, I hope they're happening for you. Congratulations on that 60 days. That's a really neat deal. I'm supposed to tell you briefly what I was like and what happened to me and what I'm like today as a result of what happened to me, and I'm going to try to do that in the next little bit. Actually, I'm through. I'm supposed to limit it to 5 minutes on it. But I'll try to do that. I grew up here in Fort Worth in a very normal family, I thought, and there wasn't any active alcoholism going on in my house, and there was a lot of drinking. My folks had two or three drinks before dinner every night, and it just always seemed like a festive time. It seemed like part of living, and a really good part of living. They had parties, and there was always booze at the parties, but I never saw anybody getting drunk and disorderly. It was a normal childhood growing up. I had two brothers, one older and one younger, and life was pretty good. I remember moving over to the west side of town. I grew up on the south side, and I moved over here on the west side when I was about 9, and I remember being ill at ease for some reason or another in this new school, in this new neighborhood, and I never really got over that. I wanted to be somebody else, someplace else, doing something else with somebody else. I just didn't fit in my skin. When I was about 14, I don't remember my first drink. I remember, though, that I went when I was about 14 to a movie with some older guys, and they had some beer, and I drank a little more beer than everybody else did, and I threw up and got home, went to bed, and got up the next morning and thought, you know, this isn't bad, this booze deal. You know, I can drink with these older guys. I got to do something about the puking, but if I can do that, this booze deal is a pretty good deal, because it made me feel different. I felt like I fit in until I puked. And that just started a pattern for me. I began drinking every time I got a chance after that, usually on the weekends. And I learned how to drink and not puke. About that time, got hooked on Speed as well. We didn't call it Speed in those days. It was Dexedrine, and that made me a little nervous, so you had to lace it with Miltown, and that was kind of a tranquilizer, and it was sort of better living through chemistry. And I did that for, I don't know, eight or nine years, and really had a hard time getting off the Speed. And looking back, of course, everything I tell you is stuff I've learned from doing this fourth and fifth step. Looking back, the way I got off the Speed was I just simply increased my alcohol intake. Nothing to it. Booze was my drug of choice, and remained that way for a long time. I was, I guess, a moderate to heavy drinker, and the book talks about the various, our book, and those of you who don't have a copy of this book, Alcoholics Anonymous, it's the owner's manual. I'd suggest that you get one and read it. If you're like us, you'll find yourselves in there. It contains the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and it contains some stories about various people like us and how they lived and what happened to them and what they were like after. I found myself in that book. I always wanted to be a big shot, because I knew if you thought I was a big shot, then maybe I could feel better about me than I did. And I always knew one day they'd write a book about me, and sure enough, they did. It's this one right here. I never thought it was going to be anonymous, but I found me in there. And if you're like me, you'll find you in there too. I was sent off to military school the last 2 years in high school, and it was either that or reform school, and I still don't know whether I made the right choice going out there, but I did, and I went from there, and every chance I could get off of that campus out there where everything was regulated, then I'd find a way to find some whiskey and drink and be with the other guys, and things were pretty good. I left there and went, I guess, after I got out of high school, from that point on until I found you guys, I was a daily drinker. I drank every day. I didn't get drunk every day, but I drank every day. And I went from New Mexico Military Institute, where everything was regulated, to the University of Texas, where everything was not regulated. And I spent the first 6 months at Schultz's Beer Garden before I found out they were holding classes up at the other end of the street. And, I thought, if they didn't care whether or not I went to class, why should I, you know? My father got to the point where he didn't care whether I went to class either or not, and he said that was the end of his financial support. So I came back up here to TCU and where I could get a job. I couldn't get a job in Austin in those days. There were so many students and so few jobs. And so I came back here and got a job and crammed a four-year course into about 6.5 out of TCU. Drinking all the time and partying and having a wonderful time. And I never was a very good student. I graduated from TCU and went out to the West Coast, moved out there to make my fortune. That didn't work. And came back here and went to law school. And for the first time in my life, I really got involved in something that I was good at and I really liked. And law school was the thing. And as I say, I was a daily drinker by that time, but because of the workload, the drinking was way down. But for the first time in my life, I used booze as a medicine. I would work hard during the week, and I'd get through 9:30 or 10 o'clock, and I couldn't go to sleep. And I found a couple of shooters who would just smooth that thing right out. And I could go to sleep, and it would just kind of shut the mind down a little bit. And I did that on a regular basis, every day. I'd get through with my work 9 or 9:30, and I'd have a couple of shooters and something to eat, and I'd go to bed. I got out of law school and had a really good job offer, and went up to Washington D.C. and worked for the Justice Department for 4 years. And again, I was drinking all the time, but I mean every day, but only after work, and it was just never. It just wasn't a problem. Booze wasn't a problem for me. It was part of life, just part of everything that was going on. I tell you that, and I also, looking back, can tell you that denial was rampant even then. I look back at I had my first automobile accident drunk before I had a driver's license. I was down in Crestwood, and I just happened to be down there the other day, and I drove past. There was a tree in the middle of the street, and I remember going right for that tree because it looked to me like there were two of them, and I was going to go between, and I ran right. And when I didn't have a driver's license. It was some family member, a neighbor's car. I was doing it without permission, and I did a lot of that. They used to call it stealing cars. I never thought of it that way. Exactly. It was, we'd borrow a car and go joyriding and take it back, and they had no sense of humor about it at all. I got caught every time. Anyhow, I got out of law school and was working for the Justice Department and had a wonderful time. And by the time I got to you guys, I heard people talking about blackouts. And if I could have taken a lie detector test and passed it, and tell you that I never had a blackout. But in doing that fourth step and talking to somebody in the fifth step, it occurred to me that I had my first blackout when I was 18 down at the University of Texas. I went to a party, and from 7:30 on, I had no memory of it. But they had pictures of me the next day. They showed me crawling around on the floor on my hands and knees, looking up the little girls' dresses. And I didn't have any memory of that. And that happened a lot by the time I got to you guys. It didn't happen often early. I mean, it was later there were a lot of blackouts. But I never thought of them as blackouts. I don't know why. I came back to Fort Worth and opened up a practice. About this time, my younger brother had left home maybe 4 or 5 years before that, and my mother started drinking pretty heavily. And by 1970, she had full-blown alcoholism. And it was really causing a problem in my family. And by that time, I'm drinking a half a quart a day, and it doesn't seem to me like I've got a problem, so I lead the family intervention on my mother. Logical choice. And I thought I knew a lot about alcoholism. I didn't. And she sobered up for a couple of years. She wouldn't go to ANA, though, because you guys just weren't her kind of folks, and so she wouldn't go. And as a result, she started drinking again. Within 4 years, she was dead of this disease. And again, I thought I knew a lot about alcoholism. I kept saying, I don't drink like she does. I can't be an alcoholic. Never even occurred to me that I was an alcoholic. All I knew was that I didn't drink like she did. And why in the hell couldn't she control her drinking? I mean, it was just a matter of willpower. You just needed to have a little willpower, and she didn't have any, and I thought it was a moral failing on her part. And I watched her die of this disease. It was a terrible thing. I got married my last year in law school, and we had a couple of boys, and the marriage was good, and the practice was great as long as I was with the Justice Department and during the law school years. And I got out and opened up a practice here, and all of a sudden the the competition was different for some reason or another. It seemed to me that the competition was, in order to be successful at law practice, you had to, one, make a lot of money, two, have a lot of toys, three, have the prestige and the good wishes of all of your peers, and I kept fighting for that and wanting that, and I got real lucky and got that all I wanted of that. And what happened was that the more successful that practice got, the less successful the marriage was. And we had these two little kids, and my wife went crazy and went into a mental institution, and she stayed there for about 6 months and came back out, and we did some family therapy, and it got a little better, and then she went crazy again and was in there for a year that time, and I was mom and dad and lawyer, and I mean, I had a lot of hats, and I tried to wear them all, and I, just to show you how selfish and self-centered I was, what happened for me was I couldn't feel any real compassion for her. All I felt was anger because she wasn't holding up her end of the deal, and I was having to hold up both our ends of the deal. And so what happened was, we went to some more family counseling, and she could tell the counselor what was wrong with her and how she felt, and I couldn't, and she got better and I didn't. That simple. We got a divorce, and I left that marriage busted, but I still had a good practice, and so the money started flowing again pretty quick, and I started playing, and I had a wonderful time for a few years. I did a lot of traveling and fun stuff, and again I was a daily drinker, and it just never occurred to me that booze was a problem for me. I was a heavy drinker, and I knew I was a heavy drinker, but I could hold my booze, you know. Besides, I was just a social drinker, right? And somebody said, and it's true for me, I was such a social drinker that every time somebody said, "I'll have a drink," I'd say, "So shall I," you know. But it just didn't seem to be a problem. I was 40 years old, and I swore I'd never get married again. One thing I got to say about that first marriage is during that time I was so angry about her not holding up her end of the deal. The result of that was that there was a bond between my kids and me that even my most active alcoholism couldn't break, and I'm really grateful for that. I didn't realize it then, but that was really a wonderful plus for me. So I swore I'd never get married again. I'm single about 5 years, and I'm playing and having a wonderful time and doing a lot of traveling, and there are a lot of relationships with women in my life. Some of them lasted a night, and some of them a few nights. That didn't seem to me to be anything strange. I mean, it just seemed to be the way it was going. And so I swore I'd never get married again. And I'm 40 years old, and I meet this 19-year-old. Blonde, gorgeous country western singer. I can't live another minute without her. And we get married and have a great time for a couple of years. And then I ran out of money and I had to go back to work. And our marriage fell apart. Strange, we went to counseling. And she could tell the counselor what she was feeling, and I couldn't, and she got better, and I didn't. You may notice a pattern here. I didn't until I got to you guys. It was a very angry and acrimonious divorce, and I left that marriage busted. But the practice was good, and so I started playing and carrying on some more, and I was having a really good time, and all of a sudden, though, my former Midas touch just turned brown. I mean, it was just like it had been a 360 degree reverse. I started making some really bad business decisions and investments, and things started cratering for me. And I did what I always had done. I had never tried to quit drinking. I've always had a weight problem, and so once in a while I would say, oh, I've ballooned up too much. I need to start running and get back in shape, and I couldn't do that and still drink, and so I quit drinking for however long it took, a month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, and it just wasn't a problem. Well, in 1986, things weren't going well, and I decided that I needed to get my life back in order in the normal way, and I was getting up every morning and saying, I'm not going to drink today, and by 5 o'clock I'd be drinking, unless it was the weekend, in which case it might be a little earlier. I remember thinking I didn't drink in the morning like my mother did. And I remember saying that after I got to you guys, and a woman that I dated some when we were both drinking was in one of those meetings when I was whining about that, and after the meeting she said, well, didn't we drink some mimosas in the mornings on Saturday or Sunday or some Bloody Marys? And I said, well, yeah, but I mean, that was the weekend. You know, that didn't count. It just never occurred to me that counted for drinking in the morning or on a trip, you know. I mean, how could that? Well, this is the only disease that I'm aware of that tells us that we don't have it, you know. Cancer doesn't tell you you don't have cancer, but alcoholism tells you there's nothing wrong with you. You drink like all the rest of those guys. It was true, I did. I drank like a lot of the rest of those guys. A lot of them are in the program today. So I called a friend of mine that he said that he wasn't drinking. And two or three of the other guys said, you know, he's really not drinking. And I tried all the stuff the book talks about, you know. It talks about beer only, wine only, drinking only in the, you know, in the afternoons, drinking only at night, taking a trip, not taking a trip, all that stuff. I tried all that stuff. But I was still getting up every morning and saying, I'm not going to drink today, and by 5 o'clock I'll be drinking. And so I go to see this guy, and we have lunch, and I say, is it really true that you haven't had a drink in 6 months? And he said, yeah. Yeah. I said, did you get any help with that? He said, yeah, I'm going to AA. You want to go to a meeting? And I thought, well, my God, AA. Jesus. I'm just like my mother. I'm a drunk, just like my mother. Got to go to A&A. That was one of the blackest days of my life. Because I really didn't set out to have on my resume that I'd be an alcoholic. I really thought that it was a moral failing, and I don't know where I got that idea. But I thought, oh shit, I've got it. And I had tried so hard and not to have it, But for me, it was like making love to a gorilla. You know, you just couldn't stop till the gorilla wanted to. Bruce had me, you know, and it just one thing I couldn't turn it loose, you know. So he told me that this buddy of his and mine too was also not drinking, and that they were going to go to an A&A meeting that night. Why don't I go with them? And I thought, oh boys, I'm really busy. But Let me check my schedule and I'll get back to you. We're incredible. We're drowning, and somebody throws us a lifeline, and it lands right beside us. And we say, wait a minute, let me give this some thought. Maybe I don't really need your lifeline. Maybe I can swim this 40 miles back to shore. We're incredible. So anyhow, the upshot of it was I went to a meeting with these guys. Went to an 8 o'clock meeting with a little SI group down here. And it was a Tuesday night. And all I remember about that meeting was that there were a bunch of clear-eyed people there who were happy to see me and asked me to come back and treated me like I had the same kind of problem they did, and all they wanted to do was share the solution that they had with me for fun and for free. I'd never been a place like that. And the laughter was great. It seemed like it was in the wrong places, but there was a lot of laughter. And that was good for me because there wasn't anything funny going on in my life at that point. One of the guys brought me a big book, and he took me home. Now, I hadn't had a drink before they came by to pick me up at 7:30 for this 8 o'clock meeting, and that was pretty late for me not to have a drink. But I didn't want to do anything to screw up their program, whatever it was, you know. So I didn't have a drink, and they got me back to the house about 9:30, and they said, can we come in a minute and talk to you, have a Coke, and talk to you about some stuff? And I said, yeah, I guess so. Because I wasn't going to have a drink in front of them, you know, and God knows what I might do to their program. And me, mine, you know, I mean, that's just, somebody said that the Alcoholics theme song ought to be, I'm always on my mind, you know. I heard one guy say, I'm not much, but I'm almost all I ever think about. So they came in and we talked for the longest hour I believe I've ever spent in my whole life. And one of these guys bought me a big book, and then they left finally, and I just couldn't wait to get over and pour me a big stiff drink and take it down. And I sat down and drank a half a quart of whiskey and read the first half of the big book. I was really a smart dude. I had two college degrees, and I could read this stuff, boy. And I was so smart, in fact, that if I'd have been that much smarter, I'd have died drunk. Just that much smarter. Thank God. The next morning, I get up and say, I'm not going to drink today, and I go off to work. And at 5 o'clock, I'm leaving a meeting where everything is falling apart, and nothing's going the way I want it to go. And I get back to my office, and I pour a couple of stiff shooters, and I go to a party and have a couple of drinks there, and then go home. Because by this time, if I go to a party and have two or three drinks, I don't want to start slurring my words and look like my mother. So if I feel that coming on, I'm in the car and I'm going home. So here's Mr. Social Drinker drinking a half a quart of whiskey every night by himself in his house. I don't know how that computes to you. It seemed to me to be social drinking. So I went home and drank another half a quart of whiskey and read the rest of that big book. Got up the next morning and said, I'm not going to drink today. 5 o'clock that day, I'm coming home from another meeting, and it's just everything's going to hell in a handbasket, and nobody's doing it the way I want them to. And I leave that meeting, and I'm walking back to my office, and at that point, I hadn't said a prayer, I bet, in 30 years, maybe 40. I had no relationship with God of any kind. I'd given up on God. I had been through a number of Protestant religions. I'd studied some Eastern religions. I had converted to Catholicism at one point when I was dating a Catholic girl who had what I wanted. And she really did. It was incredible. You could watch her go down the aisle to the front of the church and take communion, and when she stood up and turned around, she was a different person. And that was very attractive to me. And I tried that. I tried as hard as I could to find what she had in Catholicism, and I couldn't find it. So I gave up on a church, and I didn't have any kind of a relationship with God at all. And I'm walking back to my office, and I just can't wait to have a drink, and a voice or a thought or something said to me, I thought you weren't going to drink today. God, my heart started pounding, and my palms started sweating, and I looked up, and in the most skeptical way, I said, well, I guess you're going to help me out of that, and walked back to my office. And for the first time in my memory, I was out of booze at my office. I didn't have any booze in my office. And I had two emergency phone calls from clients that I had to return. It took about an hour to return these two calls. And I didn't have to have a drink. And I went back to a meeting to that little West Side group Thursday night, December the 18th, 1986, and picked up a chip. One of these guys. And I've had to have a drink since then, or any mind-altering drug. And it's been a really incredible ride. It's been an incredible ride. Thank God I didn't have to do anything to get the gifts of the program. The first gift was that I could sit down and listen. I knew the answer to everything. But for the first time, I could sit down and I could listen to you guys. Tell me how it was with you and what you were doing to stay sober. You all taught me I didn't ever have to have that loneliness or fear, that crippling loneliness and fear again. I could just come in here and be with you, and I'd be part of you, and you'd love me back to hell until I could start to love myself. And you did that for me. I started going to meetings, and I just loved the meetings. I loved the laughter, and I loved everything about it. I got a sponsor. I got started in the steps. I remember I was 90 days sober, and this woman I'd been with for 2 years split. Here I'd sobered up, cleaned up my act. Shit, that was all she wanted out of there. And my sponsor said, hooray, this will give you some time to work on your program. It's wonderful how they coddle us, isn't it? You all taught me to do five things every day. You said, get down on your knees and ask God to keep you sober in the morning for that day. End the day on your knees, thanking God for keeping you sober. Read something out of the big book and go to a meeting. Pick up that 10,000-pound telephone and call another alcoholic every day. I've been doing those five things every day for 14 years, and I haven't had to have a drink. Now, I don't know which one of those things is keeping me sober, but I'm afraid to give one of them up in case that's the one. So I'm in the habit of doing those things. They said, and then your only job is don't pick up the first drink because it's the first drink to get you. I didn't have any problem with accepting that I was powerless over alcohol. What I had problem with was that my life was unmanageable. And I said, look, I'm a partner in an international law firm. That's a big deal. And I got cars and houses and my kids are, you know. One of the guys who was in the meeting when I said that knew me a little bit and knew me before I got to you guys, and he came up to me after the meeting. He said, "Listen, your kids really are just before not speaking to you, isn't that right?" I said, "Well, yeah, I just found that out." And he said, "You've had two failed marriages, and you've had at least four failed law partnerships, and God knows how many failed business ventures." He said, "What would you pay some son of a bitch to manage your life the way you're running it?" I thought, well, I guess I'd fire him. He said, "Good answer. Let's fire him." So I had to admit that my life was unmanageable by me. And then the hard part for me was coming to believe that there was a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity. I knew I was kind of crazy, but I didn't think that there was a higher power that could help me. You know, I believed in a God that was in charge of the tides and the seasons, maybe, and the rain, but not anybody that would have an interest in me. And so first thing they told me was, you got to get down there on your knees and pray to God. And I said, that's ridiculous. I don't believe in God. And Ron Evans, Ronnie over at Legacy, told me, one of the smartest guys I know, he's an eighth grade dropout, under the bridge wino. And he said that he had the same problem. He told his first sponsor, "I don't believe in God. You want me to get down on my knees and pray to this God I don't believe in? That's ridiculous." And he said, his sponsor said to him, "What's one more ridiculous thing in your life?" He said it to me so I could understand it in a way I could hear it. And so he told me, he said, "It doesn't matter what you feel. It doesn't matter what you believe. It doesn't matter what you think. All that matters is what you do. Get down on your knees and pray to God and ask him to keep you sober." So I started doing that. And I didn't know who I was praying to. And honestly, it was like writing a note and tying it on a rock and throwing it over the wall. I didn't know if there was anybody reading it or not, you know. And finally, one day, I'm on my knees and I'm 90 days sober, or 120 days sober, and I realize that I'm sober. And it wasn't me; it had to be somebody else. They told me that this is God's con job, I think, AA, for alcoholics like us who just he couldn't get to any other way. They said, "Okay, Penner, you don't believe in God. Can you write down the qualities that a God would have that you could believe in if you were going to believe in God? Now, not that we're going to make you believe in him. You don't have to believe in him. But if you were going to, are there some characteristics that such a God might have that you could write down?" And I said, "Yes." And so I started writing down, he's all-powerful and all-knowing and all-loving and all-forgiving. And he's a little overweight and he's trying to quit smoking. And he's got a pretty good sense of humor, right? I thought I could work with a guy like that, maybe. And sure enough, I'm 120 days sober, and I'm praying to this God that you guys taught me how to design. And just that little bit of willingness to do what you guys suggested that I do, little chicken shit things that I knew couldn't possibly work. And I do them, and they work. It happens over and over and over, and has for me for 14 years. So I came to believe. But trusting in this God was a hard thing. Until one day somebody said to me, "Penner, I saw you just walk across the street in front of a bus that wasn't stopped yet. And you relied on that bus driver, whom you've never met and didn't know what the hell he might be smoking, to stop that bus at the light so he wouldn't run over you, and yet you won't trust God, who loves you more than anything in the world." And it finally clicked for me. Maybe I can trust God. Maybe I can trust God. He said, "You trust the guy next to you at 70 miles an hour not to move over into your lane?" Why can't you trust this God that loves you more than anything you can possibly imagine? He asked me, he said, Penner, he said, you've got two boys. You really love those boys, don't you? I said, yeah, I really do. He said, how much do you love them? I said, I can't describe to you how much I love those boys. He said, if your God is all-powerful and all-knowing and all-loving and all-forgiving, then he must love you even more than you love those boys. And I thought, Jesus, maybe that's right. Maybe that's right. And I began to trust. I began to trust that God has for me in store better stuff than I could ever imagine for myself if I just get out of the way. If I just be gentle with myself and get out of his way and let his will work in my life. They told me I had to take the third step. And again, Ron E. told me that when I asked him, did he think that I really ought to take the third step? He said, the worst thing can happen is it'll get it out of the hands of an idiot. What that does, the third step sets me free. All my job is to just do the next right thing, and I'm not responsible for the results. That's somebody else's business. All I can do is do the next right thing and let the results take care of themselves. You taught me the process. The process is to pray about it, use the brain that God gave me to think about it, and then decide what is the next right thing to do, and then before doing it, check it out with somebody else in Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the process that these steps teach us how to do. And I do that today. When I don't do it, I'm usually in trouble. One guy told me that the third step was simply the decision, do I like it better in here with you guys or do I want to go back out there where I came from? Just that simple. Do I like it better in here with you guys or do I want to go back out there where I came from? If I like it better in here with you guys, then all I got to do is do the rest of the steps to the best of my ability. Pick up a pencil, start writing the fourth step. I did that. First time I'd taken a hard look at me in my life. And thank God I did that, because what I found was it's me. It's not them. I thought it was those ungrateful kids, those yo-yo wives, those clients that wouldn't do what I wanted them to do. It wasn't them, it was me. It was always me. It was always me. And thank God to know that. Because if I know that it's me, I'm not the victim anymore. If it's you, if it's your action that causes me pain and suffering and ill will, disharmony, if it's your action that does that to me, then I'm screwed. Nothing I can do, because I can't change you. But if what happens is me, I can change me. I can change my perception of what's going on out there. And I'm not a victim anymore. So I went through 4 and 5, and it was a wonderful thing. I went through 6 and 7. 4 and 5 helped me get okay with me. 6 and 7 helped me get okay with God, and 8 and 9 helped me get okay with my fellows. The getting okay with God is really an interesting thing. I think the most powerful spiritual meeting I've ever been to, my brother happened to be halfway around the world, and I went around to see him in Sri Lanka, a little island off the coast of India, and I went to a meeting there, and there were a couple of Jews, and there were some Muslims, and there were some Buddhists, and some Taoists. There was some Hindu, there were some Tamils, there were Sinhalese, there were Sikhs, there were a couple of Christians, and there was me. And we were all talking about the same God. All of us, from the incredibly diverse backgrounds, we were all talking about the same God who keeps us sober. what a wonderful experience this Alcoholics Anonymous is. I recommend to you, hurry through the steps. The steps are where the payoff is. The promises that follow the ninth step have come true in my life. I've made those amends. Most days today, most days, I don't have any resentments against anybody. What a freedom. What a freedom. Most days today, most times, most days, I'm really delighted to be Dan Penner, alcoholic, right here with you guys, or wherever I am, with whoever I am, doing whatever I'm doing. You guys gave me that. I didn't know how to do that when I got here. I went busted after I was 2 years sober, and I don't recommend that to anybody. I had to file personal bankruptcy, and it was a terrible thing. But I learned a couple of things. One thing I learned was that God's the source. I'm not the source. God's the source. She's not the source. God's the source of everything good in my life. And because I had picked up that telephone and called another alcoholic every day, I had developed a group of five or six guys that I shared with on a regular basis, and I would call them and I'd say, guys, next week they're going to shut me down. You know, it's just going to be terrible. They're going to take everything I own. And they said, Peter, what do you need today that you don't have? And I'd say, but you don't understand. Next week it's just going to be terrible. Well, but what about today? What do you need today that you don't have? And the answer was always the same. Always the same. They said it to me so often that I know it at a deep level today that I got everything I need for today. I don't have everything I want for today. I don't have everything I need for tomorrow, but I got everything I need today for today, and it's been that way for a long, long time. And there's not any evidence that that's going to change. There have been so many good things that have happened to me in this program. I want to tell you what my metaphor for living is today. I learned, but I didn't learn it either. I heard it for the first time when I was about four in nursery school, and maybe you all did too. Row, row, row your boat gently down the stream. Merrily, 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 life is but a dream. My job is to row my boat. I got to do a little action, and I got to do my boat, not your boat, not her boat, my boat. Gently downstream, not up the stream or across the current, but downstream. Gently downstream, going with the flow. Easy does it. Merrily, because my book says that God's will for me is to be happy, joyous, and free. And the only person I know today standing between me and being happy, joyous, and free is me. What a concept. So I'm supposed to be happy, joyous, and free, merrily, because life is but a dream. See, it's my perception of what's going on out there that's my life. Same old stuff keeps happening out there. People come and go in our lives. We have financial ups and downs. We've got emotional ups and downs. We have physical ups and downs. The only difference between my very best day and my very worst day is my perception of what's going on out there, because it's the same old stuff. And if it's my perception of it, hooray, I can change my perception. You guys have shown me how to change my perception. One of the quickest ways I can change my perception is to write out a gratitude list. I didn't know how to do that. I had two college degrees when I got to you guys, and I didn't know how to make a gratitude list. I didn't have the foggiest notion what you were talking about. But I make a gratitude list, and I get into an attitude of gratitude, and boom, my state has changed. It's changed. You guys taught me that. I'm really grateful for that. Let me just tell you one story in closing that epitomizes Alcoholics Anonymous for me. It's a story about a guy who dies, and he goes to heaven, and St. Peter's at the gate, and And St. Peter says to the guy, before you come in, I want to give you a little test. And he says, fine. He goes in. It takes him into a room about four times the size of this room, and big banquet tables just laden with food, beautifully served, beautifully prepared, wonderful drink of all kinds, perfect crystal, silver, china. It's just so beautifully done. And the people in the room are just like you and me, except that their arms are longer than ours, and they don't bend at the elbow, and so they can't feed themselves, and they're starving. And St. Peter asked the guy, he said, what is this? He said, well, it's obviously hell. And St. Peter said, that's a great answer. Let's go in this next room. It's a room just exactly like the one that he was just in, with all this beautifully done food and drink. And the people in that room are just like us, except their arms are longer than ours and they don't bend at the elbow. But these people are happy and well-fed and slick and listening, and they're just having the best time. And St. Peter says, what's this? He says, it's AA. He said, how can you tell? He said, well, they're feeding each other. And that's what you all have done for me. Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.